council?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah.
All right, Ms. Vincent.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Selena Vincent, and I represent appellates Officers Eric Gross and Dane Schultz. Today is a very narrow question before the court, and that question is whether on February 22nd of 2021, it was clearly established that Officer Schultz and Officer Bruss had to intervene in a canine-assisted apprehension, and it absolutely was not. The plaintiff has not carried his burden to show that the law was clearly established because this Fifth Circuit has never held that officers...
Olivia, we need to start the clock. Excuse me.
No problem.
No. All right, go ahead.
Thank you. This court has never held that officers have a duty, while there is certainly a bystander duty to intervene when there is excessive force, this court has never held that there was that duty in this particular type of case involving a canine, involving officers who were bystander officers, and the canine was being handled by a canine expert. And the cases that plaintiff has put forth are completely inapplicable, do not provide the fair warning that Officer Bruss and Officer Schultz are entitled to, and do not show that every reasonable officer in the position that Officer Bruss and Officer Schultz were in would have known or would have acted differently. There's just absolutely no fair warning. And the court has before it a very recent case from the Supreme Court, Zorn versus Linton, that emphasizes the high level of specificity that is required to overcome qualified immunity. And the cases the plaintiff has offered to show this clearly established do not have that high level of specificity. In fact, they're completely in opposite to this case here. In fact, you'll see from plaintiff's briefing that mostly the argument is that it is clearly established that bystanders have a duty to intervene. That's not contested. We concede that it is clearly established that bystanders have a duty to intervene. However, Officer Bruss and Officer Schultz are still entitled to fair warning. And that's not the end of the analysis. The plaintiff is required to show that in these specific circumstances or similar circumstances, which he has not shown, these officers had a duty to intervene. Their reliance on cases that do not involve a canine at all don't get them there. Their reliance on Cooper v. Brown, although it did involve a canine, as the court said in Sly versus City of Conroe, doesn't get them there because in the Cooper case, it wasn't about bystander officers. And this court understands the importance that officers and the specialized circumstances, that officers are in circumstances where they have to make split-second decisions in rapidly evolving cases. And that's why they are protected by qualified immunity, because you don't want officers to be so hindered and so concerned that their actions would somehow expose them to liability.
Did you say Sly did not involve a bystander officer?
It did involve a bystander officer. The court there said that the plaintiff's reliance on Cooper did not show that the law was clearly established that the bystanders had a duty to intervene. That is the exact same circumstances here. Plaintiff has put forth no case to show or to overcome Bruss and Schultz's qualified immunity to show that in these circumstances, it was clearly established that they had a duty to intervene in another officer's canine-assisted apprehension. And they're going to point to, again, that because Hale, Austin, Hamilton, Kitchen, and Timpa rely on Hale and don't involve the clearly established law that those plaintiffs used, didn't involve similar circumstances, that this court and Thomas is relieved from having to put forth a case that's on point. That's not the law. That's not the standard.
Hale and Austin and Temple all involved overt acquiescence on the part of the bystander officers. You don't really have that here, do you?
Correct, Judge. Absolutely. They involved...
So in terms of the specificity of existing precedent, those cases would be inapposite here.
Totally inapplicable, as well as the fact that those cases, you can do the analysis that no reasonable officer under the Hale, Tempa, and Austin cases would have acted as those officers did, right? Because as you said, Judge, they acquiesce in an egregious use of force in those cases, as opposed to this case where Officer Bruss and Officer Schultz were not sitting by idly. Officer Bruss was clearing the car. Officer Schultz was doing backup to Officer Johnson, who was in control of the canine. So these aren't officers who just watched a beating of a suspect or a suspect being tased who was in medical distress, acquiescent to that sort of excessive force.
Well, actually, I'm trying to remember, help me with the record, sure. But one of them actually suggested that he should release the canine.
That's correct. Officer Bruss, at about 45 seconds, right towards the end, as you know, and keep in mind, Your Honors, the canine officer, the certified canine officer, the entire time was trying to end the encounter. Again, nobody's sitting by and just inflicting gratuitous force. In those 43 seconds, he walks over to Mr. Thomas. He tries to get his hands together to get the handcuffs on him. Of course, there's a little bit of a struggle. And at 45 seconds or so, Officer Bruss says, okay, when he has his hands, get the dog off the bike. So he does intervene, okay? There's no case law that says it should have happened at 20 seconds. It should have happened at 30 seconds. There's no case law at all for to give Officer Bruss and Schultz the notice that they had a duty to verbally object to another officer's use of his canine that they had no control over. That's just not the status of the case law. In fact, in Joseph v. Bartlett, this court has said that you have to identify case law clearly establishing a duty under those circumstances. General bystander liability is not enough. That is said over and over. Norman versus Engel, same situation. That's a 2025 case. And in Whitley v. Hanna, this court says context matters. Generalized bystander liability is not enough. And the reason that's the case is because if it were enough to just say these officers have a duty to intervene but not require clearly established law, they would have less protection than the officer who inflicted the force. That certainly can't be the intention. These officers are removed from the force, not only by an officer, but a dog. So they're even further removed. So to not require that Mr. Thomas establish and meet his burden to show the clearly established prong would be giving these officers less protection than the Officer Johnson.
Is there any distinction between the conduct of both officers? You mentioned that Officer Bruss cleared the car. The video shows him going over, looking in the car, clearing it. He comes around and tells Mr. Thomas on the ground, as soon as he can get those handcuffs on you, the dog will come off, and then tells the other officer to take the dog off. But the other officer doesn't do anything. So do you see any distinction, or does the law see any distinction between the conduct of the two officers?
Well, I'm glad you said that. The law does not. The law still would require Thomas to put forth a case that clearly establishes their duty to intervene. He has not put forth a case for either officers in their distinct circumstances. Do I believe that the facts are different? I do. I don't think we need to get into the facts, but I do think it's undisputed that Schultz arrived at the scene 4 minutes after the encounter, that he had the least knowledge of what was going on, and to second-guess that canine officer, he wasn't in a position to do that. All Officer Schultz saw was that Mr. Thomas refused his commands to stand up. That, you know, he was there for those 2 minutes, and that was his perspective. And so I do think Officer Bruss's situation is different. He was clearing the car. He also wasn't at the scene the whole time. But you're right, that there are factual distinctions. At the end of the day, that doesn't matter because the law was not clearly established to give the fair warning and the notice to Officer Bruss and Schultz that they had a duty to intervene in this canine-assisted apprehension. And Your Honors, I will point again to Morrow versus Meacham, which shows that an existing precedent must squarely govern, or the officers are entitled to qualified immunity. And in this case, I think it's clear, and you're allowed to rely on the video evidence under Scott v. Harris. And, context matters, certainly, as much as we don't really have to get into the facts here. You're allowed to, those are undisputed facts, what you see on the video. And there's no case that the plaintiff can put forward, has put forward, that comes close to giving those officers that notice. Again, we're talking about Timpa was a 14-minute kneeling on a suspect's back while he was in medical distress. Never mind the fact that that was after this case. That was in December 2021, after this incident here. The Austin case, again, was decided in 2023. However, plaintiffs consistently rely on that. That was tasing while this plaintiff was having an epileptic seizure. Again, how do these provide the warning and the notice that is so important? These are generalized cases that plaintiff wants to strip Officer Bress and Officer Wayne Schultz of their qualified immunity based on these cases, and he hasn't met his burden, and we ask that you reverse the district court's ruling denying Officer Bress and Wayne Schultz qualified immunity based on the fact that there is generalized bystander liability doesn't get them there and doesn't overcome their qualified immunity. Any questions? Right.
Thank you, Ms. Vinson. You've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Francis?
May it please the court, Brittany Francis on behalf of Plaintiff Appellee Mr. Kerry Thomas. I'd like to jump straight into the issues that the court has signaled interest in, which I understand to be whether the duty to intervene can only be clearly established with case law involving the same instrument of force, whether Mr. Thomas has clearly established the duty to intervene here, and I take your point, Judge Smith, about acquiescence, and whether Sly forecloses bystander liability in this case. But I think it's important to ground our discussion in the facts, which defendants have repeatedly mischaracterized. When defendants allowed a police dog to maul Mr. Thomas, he had been prone and still on the ground with his arms outstretched and his hands empty for nearly 3 minutes. He was in that position because defendants told him to be, and he complied. Despite this, defendants allowed a dog to rip apart Mr. Thomas's arm for 45 seconds, leaving him with horrific injuries and permanent disfigurement. Mr. Thomas never ran, he never physically resisted, he never made any sudden or furtive movements, and he was visibly unarmed. Defendants admitted in their deposition that they had the knowledge and the opportunity to intervene here, and they chose not to. It couldn't be clearer that the Constitution forbade the dog handler Johnson from using force on Mr. Thomas in these circumstances, so defendants are now attempting to destroy the duty to intervene in this circuit. In their view, the duty has to be established as to a specific force type, but that is not how this court has ever analyzed the duty to intervene. So turning first to the specificity.
Well, but the Supreme Court has talked about sufficient degrees of granularity, and surely you must acknowledge that the use of a canine is different in many respects. For example, that there's an experienced handler for the canine. The Supreme Court, as recently as Zorn, which has been pointed out to us, has said that you have to put officers on notice. I don't see how you can say that there don't have to be any cases about the use of canine in order to meet the second prong.
Yes, Your Honor. Zorn, it's worth noting, was not a bystander case. It was a primary force case. And there, the Supreme Court simply reiterated the standard that we agree with that has always been, that there has to be similarity of circumstance, and those circumstances have to specifically match. But this court has repeated over and over again in Cooper and in Tempa and many other cases that the instrument of force is not a relevant consideration in that specificity analysis. Specifically, the court said in Cooper, the lawfulness of force does not depend on the precise instrument used to apply it. Qualified immunity will not protect an officer merely because their means of force are novel. And the court reiterated the same in Timpa. What the court is focused on is the similarity of circumstances that the officers faced, which bears on the reasonableness of their conduct in response. And Mr. Thomas has, from the very beginning of this case, pointed to cases, specifically Hamilton, Carroll, and Hale, involving the same circumstances that Mr. Thomas faced and that the defendants faced, specifically a subject who is not resisting, who is not fleeing, who is not engaging in threatening behavior, being subjected to excessive force. And the through line through all of those cases is whether the bystander officers were aware of the constitutional violation, had an opportunity to intervene, and chose not to act. Now, Your Honor, you asked about acquiescence. And while it's true that some of these cases involved verbal encouragement and jeering and joking, not all of them did. And this court has used Hale, which did involve verbal encouragement and joking, to establish a duty to intervene in Hamilton, a case that didn't involve any verbal encouragement or commentary whatsoever. Hamilton involved, and notably, Hale involved a subject being thrown against a car and beaten, whereas Hamilton involved a roadside body cavity search. There was differences in the types of acquiescence in these cases and differences in the types of force, and this court still held that the duty to intervene was clearly established. The reason we see differences in the kinds of acquiescence in these cases not being dispositive is that acquiescence is really focused on affirmative evidence that the officer knew what was happening at the time. So joking certainly can demonstrate that they were aware and rather than unable to act. But this court has also held that silence or a failure to object in Hamilton and in Austin can demonstrate acquiescence. And then, of course, physical participation can demonstrate acquiescence. And here, we not only have a failure to object by Bress and Schultz, we also have verbal agreement from Bress mid-incident saying, he will take the dog off the bite once you're handcuffed, which notably is the exact opposite of the rule that this court established in Cooper, which is that if someone is not resisting, you can't wait until they're handcuffed to remove a dog from a bite. Similarly, after the dog was released, Bruss taunted Mr. Thomas saying, you ain't seen nothing yet. And while this comment was after the force was over, this court in Timpa credited an officer's post-force commentary as proof of acquiescence. So whatever way you cut it, these officers did engage in behavior demonstrating acquiescence. And in terms of their opportunity to intervene, this isn't up for debate. They admitted in their depositions that they had the opportunity to intervene, that they could have verbally told the handler, Defendant Johnson, to remove the bite, and that they chose not to. And so to your question about, or to counsel's point about when precisely an officer must intervene, here the officer said they could have said something sooner, and they had 45 seconds to do so, as we know from the footage. Bruss took about 5 seconds to check the car and was standing over Mr. Thomas as he was being mauled, and at the 20-second mark told Mr. Thomas, when you're handcuffed, he can release the bite. At that moment, he was already paying attention. He was watching what was happening. He could have said at that point, remove the bite. And he was required to do so, and he failed to do so. To counsel's point about this court's decision in Sly, as a district court recognized, and as I'm sure Judge King and Judge Smith, you're aware, as you decided Sly, Sly did not create a new standard for bystander liability. The plaintiff in Sly failed to cite any case law dealing with the duty to intervene, and it was that briefing failure that drove this court's decision to throw out her bystander claims. She only relied on Cooper, which was not a bystander case, and was materially distinct from the facts in her case. Cooper did not involve a resisting subject, and Cooper involved intentionally prolonged force, whereas in Sly, the dog was ignoring commands to release. So on these grounds, the court determined that Sly's claims failed. But Sly does not stand for the maximalist proposition, as the district court noted, that a plaintiff must identify a dog bite bystander case in order for bystander defendants to be on notice of their responsibility to intervene. Turning to, breaking this analysis down in a more granular way, it seems defendants take issue with Mr. Thomas relying on Cooper to establish an underlying constitutional violation and then relying on Hale, Carroll, and Hamilton to establish a duty to intervene. But this two-prong approach is something this court has done repeatedly. In Carroll, this court used Amador, Ambler, and Austin to establish the underlying excessive force and then used Hale to establish the duty to intervene. Similarly, in Hamilton, this court used Roe and Flores to establish the underlying excessive force and then used Whitley and Hale to establish the duty to intervene.
Now, Sly was decided after the events in this case, right?
Your Honor, I had thought that it was decided beforehand, but regardless, our position is that Sly did not alter the bystander liability standard in this case. In terms of the expertise required to engage with a police canine, which counsel emphasized heavily, it's worth noting that this court has never said an officer's subjective knowledge or individual expertise drives a duty to intervene. The duty to intervene exists regardless of rank or specialty. But Bruss is an experienced canine handler. He testified under oath that he has 15 years of experience and has trained hundreds of canine handlers. And as demonstrated belatedly on the scene, he was comfortable and was able to tell Johnson to release the dog from the bite. So there's no concern here in the specific facts of this case that he lacked the expertise necessary to intervene. I would also emphasize, Your Honor, that defendants' case law, Joseph, Norman, and Howard, don't establish that the duty to intervene is somehow heightened in recent years, because all of these cases turned on plaintiff's failure to cite any case law establishing a duty to intervene. So in Joseph, this court made clear plaintiff did not identify a single case to support the argument that any officer would have known to intervene under these circumstances. We make no comment on whether plaintiff could have done so. The record simply shows they have not. Similarly, in Norman, plaintiff pointed to no case clearly establishing the duty to intervene. And it's worth noting that in Norman, the underlying force was ultimately deemed reasonable, and the bystander did intervene within 5 or 6 seconds, both verbally and physically, putting that case on a different track than Mr. Thomas's case. And then finally, Howard, a Southern District case, plaintiff briefed the issue but only cited out-of-circuit cases, which the court concluded applied a different standard. So none of these cases require this court to find that defendants did not have a duty to intervene. The weight of the law establishes the opposite. And defendants were not required to physically intervene either. They could have verbally intervened, and this court credited verbal intervention as an option in Austin and has done so, has held officers responsible for their silence alone in many cases, including Hamilton and Austin. Your Honors, if there are no further questions.
I do have a question.
Yes.
What is your best case that predates the events in this case to show that all reasonable officials in the defendant's circumstances would have known that their conduct violated the right to intervene?
That's Hale, Your Honor, though we would also rely on Hamilton and Carroll, because all of these cases make clear that presence and awareness of unconstitutional behavior combined with a failure to take reasonable measures to protect someone from excessive force make bystanders liable. And these cases are all on point and on all fours with Mr. Thomas's case because they all involve subjects who were not physically resisting, who were not fleeing, who were not engaging in threatening behavior. And on those grounds, excessive force was not warranted and intervention was required.
When a case like this is tried, does anyone put on evidence from maybe the city, whoever is about exactly what kind of training is done on this subject? I mean, they actually say, all right, in the police academy, this is what we do, this is what we say. Do they actually put that evidence on?
Your Honor, I think, yes, they could and probably will if this case is permitted to go to trial.
That's absolutely amazing. I mean, that whatever their approach should be, ought to be the subject that they teach and that people say, this is how you have to do this or else.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. And to that point, during defendant's depositions, we inquired about how they are trained to assess whether resistance is active or passive, at what point a dog bite or similar levels of force are appropriate. And defendants made clear that they understood Mr. Thomas's behavior as passive resistance and that passive resistance does not justify the use of canine force.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Francis. Ms. Vincent for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you. I think plaintiff's argument just emphasized that they are attempting to diminish the plaintiff's burden in this case, and the burden is to show clearly established law, not to show that we've got some other cases that didn't require the plaintiff to show clearly established law, so this court in this case shouldn't do it now. Again, as we have pointed out, none of the cases they rely on, and I think she said that the case, the Hale is the one she's pointing to, would provide the officers the notice that they're entitled to. It's simply just not the case. And the fact that the officers said they could have intervened, again, is not the end of the analysis. You still have to show they were on notice that they had a duty to intervene under the circumstances. And, you know, opportunity doesn't overcome the plaintiff's burden to show clearly established law. With respect to what the court said in her memorandum and opinion regarding the Sly case and what plaintiff's argument was, that the Sly court, this court, did not the Sly court certainly wasn't saying that as long as you point to more cases, regardless of whether or not they clearly establish a duty to intervene, then the qualified immunity can be overcome. Certainly, the court was not only saying that not only did the plaintiff not cite any cases, none of them were on point. And that is the situation here.
Well, Hale, if that's their strongest point, was materially different. The suspect was complying. There was no weapon alleged to be present, as there was here. The bystander officers were on the scene for the entire event. And the bystander officers actively lured the suspect outside for the beating that he suffered.
Certainly. Absolutely inapplicable.
I don't see how Hale is even remotely.
They laughed during the encounter. The plaintiff's counsel mentioned that Russ said as soon as the officer gets you in handcuffs, he'll release the dog. That is not the same as laughing. That's not the same as sitting idly by and encouraging an infliction of excessive force. Doesn't even come close. So again, plaintiff has not met his burden. It's not enough to show they could have intervened. Must identify precedent placing the bystander's alleged duty beyond debate. And it certainly is not here. And the facts and the law do not overcome Officer Bruss and Officer Schultz qualified immunity in this case, and we ask that you reverse the district court's ruling.
All right, thank you, Ms. Vincent. Your case is under submission. The last case for today, Sealed Appellee versus Sealed Juvenile.